You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Time now for our weekly review of state politics. Here to discuss is Rick Glaser, a former State House representative and current executive director of the left-leaning NC Justice Center, and Mitch Kokai, senior policy director at the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Three bills dealing with the judiciary advanced swiftly through the State House this week. Each would effectively strip the governor of some appointment power. Lawmakers would gain authority to fill district and special superior court vacancies. The governor presently has that right. Now, while another measure would reduce the State Court of Appeals from 15 to 12 judges, this would keep Governor Roy Cooper from appointing anticipated vacancies in the next 2 years. Smells to me like legal challenges could be coming on these. Mitch, are these changes really necessary?
I don't know that they are necessary, but what I think you see is this is just the latest example of what is becoming a pattern of the General Assembly deciding that, hey, we like to have a lot more power, and we think the governor should have less power, so let's find another way that we could put more power into the hands of the General Assembly than in the hands of the governor. It's the type of thing I think the legislature would like to do in general. They're one of the three branches of government and would like to see as much power in the hands of their branch as possible. When you had a Republican-led General Assembly and a Republican governor, it was a little bit harder for them to justify it. Now that there's a Democratic governor, they think, well, hey, let's go ahead and get as much of the power as we can.
The state appellate court expanded from 12 to 15 justices or judges back under Democratic rule, and now it potentially is going to sway the other way and get a little bit smaller. Power grab, simple as that, goes both ways?
Yes, it is a power grab. And Mitch is right in a sense. I would just go a little further and say this legislature thinks it's the only branch of government. This idea that the court system that handles 1,500 cases a year and has been increased by actions of the General Assembly in December to create en banc capacity, meaning it should handle more cases, should have less judges than the branch or the court that handles about 50 cases a year, doesn't make sense, except if you think about it, Jeff, in the long-term vision. And although the Republicans have denied it, this clearly is stage one of a court packing plan.
Expound a little bit further for me. You're expecting what?
I'm certainly expecting that there to be, in the next year or two, an attempt to increase the size of the Supreme Court, matched by the decrease in size in the Court of Appeals, shift in designation, which this process has started about which court handles which cases, and I think a move to justify by workload, which doesn't exist now, increasing the Supreme Court justices and the ability of the legislature to appoint them, just as two of these bills suggest, in district court and superior court, and at the same time then to regain in the partisan control in their mind of the Supreme Court.
Now one reason why that could come to pass is, as Rick knows, our state constitution actually spells out that the General Assembly can do this. We have one Chief Justice and six associate justices on our state Supreme Court. And I think it surprised a lot of people to learn right after the election of 2016 that the state constitution actually spells out that the General Assembly can add two more associate justices. Now, there was some talk at the time right after the election that the General Assembly would come back to town, do this, allow outgoing Republican Governor Pat McCrory to make those appointments so that the so-called partisan advantage for Democrats, 4-3, would flip back to 5-4 Republican. They decided not to do that, but they could at any time, because of our Constitution, go back and appoint two more justices.
And if they did, if the General Assembly were to expand the state's highest court from 7 to 9, or I suppose even 11 or 13, it would be the governor who would fill those seats at least until the initial election, no?
Well, I mean, the process of whatever the legislature sets out as the vacancy-filling process might be out there. I think with the Supreme Court, there are constitutional limitations that may take place that would stop that. I think the first thing is to recognize that these bills passed with less than a veto-proof margin, and one would suspect that the governor will veto, and I don't think, at least right now, there appear to be votes to override.
Anything else to add on this?
Yeah, I think certainly on the bills that dealt with the General Assembly appointing district court judges and special superior court judges, it looks like it would be difficult to override the governor's veto. The bill that has the possibility that these three appeals court seats could disappear by attrition once Republican members on the court have to retire because of mandatory retirement age. That one had a little bit more support in the House. If it gets a lot of support in the Senate, that might be able to survive a gubernatorial veto. But I'm guessing all of them will be challenged.
Meanwhile, lawmakers continued to champion the STOP Act this week. That's Strengthen Opioid Misuse Prevention. Really, it should be the STOMP Act, but we'll table that for now. This is a bill with a lot of support from both parties. It seeks to change prescription drug protocols for opiates. I'd love to hear from each of you one component of this bill that you like and perhaps an element or something that you would like to see changed. Mitch?
Well, I think the idea of stepping up the restrictions on being able to get these opiates in the hands of people who don't need them or who there's a strong question about whether they need them, that is a positive. I think the other positive is that we're seeing some bipartisan support on this. Now, we're seeing Republican General Assembly members who are the lead sponsors, but one of the people that they've had right on board with them is our new Democratic Attorney General, Josh Stein, who's been very involved. And the fact that both of these parties are working very closely on this is a good sign for this legislation.
Any concerns about this bill?
You don't want to step too far into limiting people's liberty and to put so many obstructions in place that people who actually need to get these medications will have a hard time getting them. But these are such dangerous medications that having a stricter amount of controls in place than you would see for some other types of medications may be warranted.
I think the plus side of the bill, and there are many, and I agree the bipartisanship here is complete and across the board, is the $10 million a year that's going to be added into drug treatment, and that really is severely needed across the board for both of the years. So a $20 million price tag.
This would be in the state budget.
This would be in the state budget, and I think that's important. My only concern at all would be along the lines of what Mitch said, but I would suggest that there needs to be a little clearer view of when physicians who believe that their patients need more than an initial 5-day supply or need more than the supply would otherwise allow, that they have waiver capacity for what's in the best medical interest of their patient once they comply with all of the rest of the procedures. Assuming that is the case because of the dangerous nature, the addictive nature, and the clear evidence of substantial number of overdose cases and abuse of the system, I think the bill is a good bill.
This bill limits initial prescriptions for acute pain to 5 days, 7 days after surgery. This measure would also require medical providers to check a database before prescribing opiates. That would be an aim to reduce doctor shopping. One thing that I did note, if you have a response to it, would love to hear on it, there isn't anything written into the legislation on the number of pills that can be prescribed, meaning if a patient has back pain or surgery, outpatient, major surgery, whatever it is, it would be a 7-day prescription, but there's no limit on the number of pills that could be prescribed, at least as I read it, as I understand it, meaning you could still be prescribing 60, 90, 120 pills, which is part of the reason we have an epidemic and we're having this conversation.
Well, I think there's truth there, and I think part of this is not only a deterrence measure, but also an education measure across the board. I think it would be hard to put into law a limitation on the dosage or the amount of pills, given the immense variety of surgical and chronic conditions that may require the medication legitimately. And so I think that's just awfully difficult to write into law. But I think the message is being sent with large shots across the bow here about we're going to be looking at this data. We expect you to look at this data per patient and per prescriber. And just know that this is no longer sort of an isolated field between the patient and the doctor with no oversight.
And it's always dangerous to get the legislators and also government bureaucrats into the business of telling what doctors what they ought to be able to do. So there is some cause for concern about opiates and to have some laws in place that, as Rick was saying, really just fire that shot across the bow saying we're going to be watching, but you don't want to dictate too much.
Raise the Age has also emerged again. This is a proposal that would give the juvenile criminal justice system jurisdiction over 16 and 17-year-olds. This is for nonviolent crimes. North Carolina is one of the only remaining states that automatically prosecute as adults. Similar proposals in recent years have failed. Why might this yield a different outcome?
I think it will this year. I think there is much broader support. There's been a lot of work on this bill, really, in its in many forms for 10 years now. Again, a very bipartisan bill and cross branches of government. You've got, I think, essentially most of the law enforcement community on board. You've got the Chief Justice on board, the Chief Justice's Commission, the Administrative Office of the Courts. You've got certainly all of the children's advocates on board. And so I think it is also a bill that has the limitations that will feel comfortable for a lot of people, both on the financing of the bill and the change or transitioning in the bill. But it's long been needed. We're the only state other than New York where 16-year-olds are in the adult system. And to the extent that it stops people who are 16 and 17 who commit even minor crimes from having clean records to access universities, to access the military, to access jobs, the only students it's hurting are North Carolina students. Everyone else who moves here has a slate that's clean because it's closed in a juvenile court. And so we're disadvantaging only our own students, and I think people have finally recognized that.
I think it's worth noting also that two of the groups that are supporting this are our groups, North Carolina Justice Center and the John Locke Foundation, which disagree on almost everything in public policy, but there are some things that we agree on, and this is one of them. Among the objections over the years that I've heard about this bill, one is the upfront cost. Almost everyone agrees there's going to be long-term savings, but the idea is, well, how much upfront cost are you going to have to put out, and is that going to be something that is going to be too much given the long-term benefits that are likely to happen? I think most of the people who are on board with this think those upfront costs are worth it for the potential long-term benefits. The other objection that we still hear occasionally is from the prosecutors who have said, look, you know, I understand completely your idea, that the notion of this is great, but some of these 16 and 17-year-olds are already hardened gang members, and we don't want them in the same system as the kids who can be saved. And so I think that's something that needs to be worked through. It seems as if most of the prosecutors at least aren't raising a huge objection at this point, but there is still some sentiment out there that perhaps some of these 16 and 17-year-olds are already far along enough on the criminal path that it would be a bad idea to have them in the same boat as 16 and 17-year-olds who would benefit from this change.
And I think that the way to handle that and the way the bill attempts to handle it is to recognize that those who commit violent crimes, number one, don't necessarily fall under the bill, but even if they fell under the bill, you would be able to immediately transfer them from juvenile court to adult court and treat them as adult offenders.
And really what happens is this just changes the default setting in many respects.
Okay.
I mean, basically, default setting has been 16 and 17-year-olds in the adult system. Now it would be for all nonviolent offenders, 16 and 17-year-olds, the default would be the juvenile system. But as was just mentioned, you could certainly, if the circumstances warranted this, have them transferred to adult court.
Right. More fireworks in D.C. this week, to the surprise of no one. The American Health Care Act has received a lot of publicity and attention and some support and some criticism. North Carolina's congressional delegation, I thought it was interesting. So North Carolina has 13 U.S. House members, 10 of whom are Republican, 3 Democrats. The Democrats obviously are going to be against this proposal. But we've also heard pretty quickly and vehemently from some of the Republicans, Mark Meadows, who's the head of the Freedom Caucus, Mark Walker, David Rouser. I believe there may be others. Those folks are opposed to it. Is North Carolina's congressional delegation a microcosm of just how complicated this is?
Yeah, I think it very much is. It is. That's why it took so long and was such a divided vote and caused so much consternation when the Affordable Care Act was first put into play. And I think that President Trump and the Republicans who now have caught the car with the dog that they wanted are now seeing that. And I think you've got on the right-hand side very much folks who I think disagree that they're calling it Obama Light or Paul Ryan care, and looking at the cost of it and the fact that it keeps considerable basic benefits in place, but on the left side or the moderate side even of the issue with the ACA, you're looking at a bill that repeals with fairly substantial completeness, the Affordable Care Act. It's going to cause a fairly massive funding cut in Medicaid, and we're going to lose coverage for many North Carolinians across the board. So I think it's being attacked on the left and right. It's being attacked by organizations on the left and right, as well as almost all the medical professional organizations. And I think with that many opponents, it's very difficult to see a path for this bill, even if it gets out of the House, for it to ever come to fruition in its existing form in the United States Senate.
Mitch, where do you fall on this bill? Do you support it? And isn't it dead on arrival, right?
It certainly is not going to pass in the form that it's in right now. I think our organization has taken a look at it, and the person within our organization who knows much more about healthcare policy than I do would agree with the assessment of some that it's more Obamacare light. But I think one of the problems this piece of legislation faces is that by design, it's one of only about three different things that the supporters say would have to happen to get to the final destination. That they're trying with this bill to address what can be done through what is a phrase that only wonks could love, the budget reconciliation process. And so there are only a limited number of things that could be done to the Affordable Care Act through that process. Also, some changes would have to take place with the Department of Health and Human Services, and then a third round of changes through a standalone bill. So I think a lot of the people who really wanted to come at it and see complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act, take everything back to the way things were in 2010, they're looking at this bill and saying, well, it's not going to do that. And even the supporters are saying, yes, we know it's not going to do that. Plus, the other thing we need to keep in mind, a lot of people who supported the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, or, you know, get rid of Obamacare, have this notion that we're going to go back to the way things were in 2010 before it was passed. Even if you wanted that, even if that was your goal, it's not going to happen because right. The healthcare system is completely different. Many of the things that were in place in 2010 no longer are in place because we've had several years of the Affordable Care Act.
Mitch Kokai is Senior Policy Director at the Conservative John Locke Foundation, and Rick Glaser is Executive Director of the Progressive NC Justice Center and a former House Rep from Cumberland County. Thank you both.
Thanks, Jeff.
You.